April, May. Who are these guys? April 4th. Opening day. Notes on addiction. I've written about substance abuse a good many times and see no need to rehash all that in a book about baseball. But because this also happens to be a book about rooting, the subject at least has to be mentioned, it seems to me. These are a fan's notes, after all, and when used in the context of rooting, the word fan ain't short for fantastic. I don't booze it up anymore, and I don't take the mind or mood-altering drugs, but over a good many years of staying away from those things one day at a time, I've come to a more global view of addiction. Sometimes I think of it as the lump-in-the-sofa cushion theory of addiction. This theory states that addiction to booze or dope is like a lump in a sofa cushion. You can push it down, but it will only pop up somewhere else. Thus, a woman who quits drinking may start smoking again. A guy who quits the glass pipe may rediscover his sex drive and become a serial womanizer. A gal who quits drinking and drugging may put Twinkies and strawberry ice cream in their place, thus adding 40 or 50 pounds before putting on the brakes. Hey, I've been lucky. No sex issues, no gambling issues, moderate food issues. I do, however, have a serious problem with the Boston Red Sox, and have ever since they came so damn close to winning the whole thing in 67. Before then, I was what you might call a recreational Red Sox user. Since then, I've been a full-blown junkie, wearing my hat with the Scarlet B on the front for 6 months straight, and suffering a serious case of hathead while I obsess over the box scores. I check the Boston Red Sox official website, and all the unofficial ones as well, most of them fucking dire. I scoff at the so-called curse of the Bambino, believing completely in my heart, even though I know it is the bullshit creation of one talented and ambitious sports writer. Footnote, the Boston Globe's Dan Shaughnessy. Worst of all, during the season, I become as much a slave to my TV and radio as any addict ever was to his spike. I have been asked by several people if working on this book is a hardship, given the fact that I have two other books coming out this year, the final novels in the Dark Tower cycle, a television series still in production that would be Kingdom Hospital on ABC, the Detroit Tigers of network broadcasting, and a half-finished new novel sitting on my desk. The answer is no, it's not a hardship, but a relief. I would either be sitting at Fenway or in my living room with the TV tuned to NESN, the New England Sports Network, the regional pusher that services addicts like me, in any case. This book legitimizes my obsession and allows me to indulge it to an even greater degree. In the language of addiction, the book's publisher has become my enabler, and my colleague, Stuart Onan, is my codependent. Now, 9 hours before Sidney Ponson of the Orioles throws his first pitch to the first Red Sox batter of the season, I can look at my situation coldly and clearly. I am a baseball junkie, pure and simple. Or perhaps it's even more specific than that. Perhaps I'm a Red Sox junkie, pure and simple. I'm hoping it's choice B, actually. If it is, and the Sox win the World Series this year, this nearly 40-year obsession of mine may break like a long-term, very long-term, malarial fever. Certainly this team has the tools. But Red Sox fans do not need the bad mojo of some false curse to appreciate the odd clouds of bad luck that often gather around teams that seem statistically blessed. Outfitted in the offseason with strong pitching and defense to go with their formidable hitting, the Sox suddenly find themselves short two of their most capable players. Nomar Garciaparra and Trot Nixon. 2003 batting champ Bill Miller, suffering supposed elbow problems from swinging a leaded bat in the on-deck circle, I wonder, has seen little spring training action. And Cadillac closer Keith Falk has been, let's face it, nothing short of horrible. But for the true junkie, true fan, such perverse clouds of darkness do not matter. The idea of starting 0-22, for instance, as the Orioles once did, is pushed firmly to the back of the mind. Footnote. where it festers. There will be no Sopranos tonight at 9, even if the Sox trail by 5 in the 7th inning. There will be no Deadwood tonight at 10, even if Keith Falk comes on in the 8th, blows a 3-run Sox lead, and then gives up an extra 3 for good measure. Tonight, barring a stroke or a heart attack, I expect to be in until the end, be it bitter or sweet. And the same could be said for the season as a whole. I'm going to do pretty much what I did last year, in other words. Only this year I expect to get paid for it, which is pretty much addiction in a nutshell. Doing the same thing over and over, and expecting a different result. Right now it's only 10 o'clock, though, and the house is quiet. No one's playing baseball yet. I'm fever-free for another 9 hours, and I'm enjoying it. Don't get me wrong, I'll enjoy the baseball game, too. The first one's always a thrill. I think that's true even if you're a Tigers or a Devil Rays fan, a team that looks much improved this year, by the way. But by August, in the heat of a pennant race, I always start to resent the evening spent following baseball and to envy the people who can take it or just turn it off and read a good book. Myself, I've never been that way. I'm an addict, you see, and I'm a fan. And if there's a difference, I don't see it.
Opening on the road sucks. You can't feel the perfect newness of the season up close. A true home opener is a pearl, smooth and untouched. Not this year. By the time the team gets to Fenway, whether we're 4-0 or 0-4, the season will have been rubbed up, scuffed, cut, and it'll still be cold. It's 43 and breezy in Baltimore. Hot dog wrappers and plastic bags drift by behind the home plate ump. I'm at home digging the game on Nesson from my cozy couch. Don Orsillo and Jerry Remy talk about opening day jitters, and to prove them right in the first, Bill Miller throws one wide of Millar. Melvin Mora lets him off the hook by trying to take third on a bloop single, and Manny easily guns him down. In the top of the next inning, Mora lifts his glove and lets a grounder go through his legs. The heart of the O's lineup is made of their big offseason free agents. Former MVP Miguel Tejada, and All-Stars Rafael Palmeiro and Javi Lopez. In the second, Lopez, seeing his first pitch as an O, plants a high fastball from Pedro in left field seats, and the crowd chants, Javi, Javi. Don points out that the fastball was clocked at 89. Pedro's missing the plate, pulling his hard curve a good 2 feet outside on righties. Gibbons singles. Then Pedro plunks David Segui. There are no outs. Bigby hits an excuse-me roller to Pedro, who checks second and goes to first. The throw's to the home side of the bag and looks like Millar can handle it, but it tips off his glove and skips away. Gibbons scores and the runners move up. Pedro, Pedro, the crowd taunts. He leaves a changeup up to Matos, who singles in Segui. Matos steals second. In the bullpen, Bronson Arroyo is warming. Don and Jerry debate the possibility that something's physically wrong with Pedro. Maybe he's having trouble gripping the ball in the cold. Pedro quiets them and the crowd by striking out Roberts and Mora, bringing up Tejada, who looks thicker around the middle, positively husky for a shortstop. He hits one deep to right center that Johnny Damon tracks down, and we're out of it. Jerry says we're lucky to be down only 3 runs, and while he's right, I don't feel lucky. 2 innings into the opener, and the season's turning to shit. We get a run back in the top of the third when Manny rips a single off Ponson's back leg. In the bottom, Bellhorn and Pokey turn a nifty 2 to end the inning and touch gloves on their way to the dugout. So some things are working. In the fourth, on a ball to the right field corner, with 2 down and the number 9 hitter coming up, Dale Swaim holds Kapler at third, though the throw goes into second without a cutoff man. Don't be stupid, I plead. Too late. And then Pokey, for no reason I can see, tries to sneak a bunt past Ponson and is an easy third out. Pedro settled down, giving up only 2 hits since the second. It's still only 3-1 in the seventh when David Ortiz launches one down the right field line, foul. In the seventh, Timlin comes in and walks 2, gives up a bloop to Tejada and a Palmeiro single through a shifted infield, and it's 4-1. Dave Wallace makes a visit to the mound but doesn't take Timlin out. The next batter, Javi Lopez, hits a long fly to right center that hangs up, Johnny D tracks it as the wind takes it away from him. Kapler's angling him from right to back up the play. Johnny looks up, then looks over at Kapler. Kapler looks at Johnny. The ball lands between them. With two outs, everyone's running, and Palmeiro hoofs it all the way around from first. This is when everyone leaves, including Trudy. It's 11 o'clock on a Sunday, and the game has been plain ugly. It continues that way. The reliever for the O's walks the bases loaded and gives up a run on a fielder's choice. Later, Cesar Crespo makes a throw in the dirt that Millar should scoop but doesn't, letting in another run. In the top of the ninth, it's 7-2 and 30 degrees, and Camden Yards is empty. Yet the fans I see behind the dugout, this is so typical it makes me laugh, are all Red Sox fans. And here I am, the only one left awake in the house, watching to the bitter end. Tom Caron and Dennis Eckersley break it down on extra innings. But really, what can you say about a game like this? The most obvious stat is 14 men left on base. Johnny D went 0-for-5 in the leadoff spot. Tech went 0-for-4. Timlin gave up 3 earned runs in 2/3 of an inning, and one of those outs was Tech cutting down a runner on a risky pitch out. They pick on Pokey, showing the bunt attempt. X says he understands the strategy, but if it doesn't work, it looks horrible. They also examine Millar's footwork on the throwing error charged to Pedro that kept the O's rally going. Instead of posting up at the front corner of the bag with his right foot so he can stretch toward Pedro with his left and his glove, Millar is facing the bag with his left foot in the center so that he has to reach across his body to handle the throw. Basically, he nonchalanted it and cost us a couple of runs. I turn it off. What's demoralizing isn't losing. We'll lose 60 to 70 games this year, knock wood. It's playing badly. If this had been the first week of the NFL season, the announcers would have said this team has a lot of work to do. April 5th. I can't help running a quick postmortem, scanning the story in the morning paper. Francona stands by his man Swaim, saying Kapler would have been meat if he'd gone. I hope this kind of denial isn't indicative of the new emperor. I get an email from Steve.
The bad news this morning is that the Red Sox lost their opener, and Pedro looked very mortal. The good news is that there was baseball.
Pedro had a bad inning, helped along by Millar. Still, he settled down after the second, and we were in the game till Timlin let it get away. Think Pokey bunted on his own? Is he going to be like Steve Psycho Lyons?
Yeah, I think Pokey Reese bunted on his own, and I think it was the break point in the game for the Red Sox. You can say there are a lot of games left, and I would agree, but Gil Hodges, I think it was Hodges, said, first games are big games. And if he meant they set the tone, I agree. And I know, two-out rallies are always chancy. All the more reason to play it straight, right? Here's your situation. Millar, who really only hits middle relievers with reliability, opens the fourth by flying out to center. Kapler singles. Tech money, Tech small change in April, hits a bat-busting pop to short, two out. Bellhorn doubles, runners at second at third. That sets the stage for Mr. Reese, who can tie the game with a righteous single. Instead, he bunts hard and is out easily, pitcher to first. Easy to read his thinking. Ponson's a porker. If I place it right, I get on to load him up for Johnny Damon, or maybe Kapler scores. But even if Kapler does score, we're still behind. And that early in the game, you'd think he'd be swinging away. So yeah, I think it was a plan he hatched in his own head and a classic case of a baseball player taking dumb pills. Which leads me to something my elder son said this afternoon. Dad, I don't envy you this book. You could have picked the wrong year. A team this high octane could stall with the wrong manager and be out of it in the first month. I don't say it will happen, but he's got a point, and I hope the pokester got a stern talking to about that bunt. I don't intend to deconstruct every game or even most of them, but that bunt made me a lot more uneasy than the way Pedro Martinez threw on a cold night.
It's opening day for the rest of the league, and ESPN has wall-to-wall coverage. I catch pieces of the Cubs-Reds game, Sean Casey, a Pittsburgh native, blasts a two-run double off of Kerry Wood. A rare TV appearance by the Pirates taking on Kevin Millwood and the Phils, my brother somewhere in the freezing center field bleachers, and the Astros with Nolan Ryan in the dugout hosting Barry Bonds, Willie Mays, and the Giants. Lots of home run talk, but not a word about steroids from Joe Morgan. I watch the games with mild interest, but can't commit to any of them. I wish the Sox were playing today, so we could get back on the winning track and ditch this bad morning after feeling. It's just impatience. I've waited all winter for Schilling. I can wait one more day. April 6th. I have to do a reading over in Bristol, Rhode Island. It's a gig I set up months ago, hoping it wouldn't interfere with opening day. It won't, but today's game in Baltimore starts at 3:05, and I'm meeting a class then, and dining with the faculty at 5:30. My host, Adam, says we could have a beer in between and catch a few innings. We find a bar down by the water with the sun flooding through the windows. The place must have 6 TVs. None of them is showing the game. We start some chatter about Schilling making his debut, and a pair of regulars join the chorus. The barmaid finds Nesson for the big screen on the wall. Beside it is a printout of a picture I've seen on eBay. A little tow-headed boy about 3 years old in a sock shirt on someone's shoulders. He's leaning toward the field, screaming and giving someone a tiny finger. There's Schilling sitting on the bench, going over something on a clipboard. It's 3-1 Sox in the 7th, and Embry's in. The O's only have 6 hits, so I assume Schilling threw well. The two locals at the bar next to us start grousing about Pedro leaving Sunday's game before it was over. When are they going to do something about him? In the 8th, Melvin Mora hits a medium deep fly to right center. Johnny D drifts over. It's his ball, obviously, but Millar, unaccustomed to playing right, keeps coming. The memory of the pop falling between Johnny and Kapler Sunday night is still fresh, and neither takes his eyes off the ball. Johnny gets there first. As he makes the catch, his shoulder catches Millar flush in the face, knocking him on his ass like a vicious blindside on a kick return. Millar stays down. The guys in the truck roll the collision between Johnny and Damian Jackson in last year's playoffs, Johnny's head snapping back, and then the ambulance idling on the outfield grass. They show it twice, both times getting a vocal reaction from the whole bar. Then they show today's collision 2 more times. Millar spits a little blood, but he looks more dazed than anything, blinking and squeezing the bridge of his nose. He comes out, and Cesar Crespo makes his debut as a right fielder. The next batter, Tejada, hits a fly to deep right center. This time, Johnny waves his throwing hand high above his head to call off Crespo, and that's the inning. Fulk is warming, but we have to go to dinner. We're already 20 minutes late. They look like they're in good shape, Adam says as we head to the restaurant.
Never say that, I say.
I get an email from Steve.
Nice game today. It went almost exactly the way the Bosox geneticists would like them to go. You get 6 innings from Schilling, who gives up a single run. 1 inning from Embry, no runs. 1 inning from Timlin, no runs. And 1 from Fulk, who gets the save. Also on the plus side is my Bosox club hat, which seems to be quite lucky. I plan to wear it until the lining falls out. P.S. More questions about Francona. 1. Was Pedro consciously testing the new manager's authority by leaving when he did during the first game? 2. Was F. wrong to pull Manny from the field when he did, thus denying Manny the chance to bat in the 9th inning? 3. What's up with his unwillingness to sacrifice the runners to the next base? Bases.
Number 1. Don't know what's up with Pedro, but it seems early to be riding the guy. Number 2, yes, definitely a mistake to pull Manny when Millar's the non-outfielder out there. See what happened? Number 3, his distaste for the sack bunt is straight from the Bill James Bible. Don't give up any outs, even what we might think are necessary ones.
Also, the guy just doesn't look like a manager to me. Jan Francona has a lean and stupid look.
Well, Grady didn't exactly strike me as a Stephen Hawking figure. April 7th. Not only did the Sox win, but the Yanks lost. The D-Rays beat on Messina again, so they're on top of the division. Go, you crazy Lou. Schilling threw 109 pitches yesterday, topping out at 98 miles per hour. I know the gun down there is fast because it clocked Ponson at 97, but still, knowing Schilling's strong makes me optimistic about the season. While I was out yesterday, Matt from my agent's office called and left a message with Steph that says he wants to talk about opening day. I'm thinking it has to do with tickets, but it's about opening day in Baltimore. He went. A friend came up with tickets at the last minute, and he put everything aside and hopped on a cheap flight. He says the wind was crazy. The two big aureole weather vanes on top of the scoreboard in center were spinning in opposite directions. He was surprised at the venom of the O's fans. After Pedro hit Seguí, they were chanting, "Pedro sucks." I'm not surprised. Pedro can come off as arrogant, and after dominating for so long, he's earned some payback. The same with the Sox lately. They're a high-paid, high-profile club, and the second-division teams have a right to dislike them. Tonight's game is a pitching mismatch. D'Lo versus the young Kurt Ainsworth. This is one main strength of the 2004 Sox. Over the last 2 years, Lowe's won more games than any AL pitcher except the Jays' Roy Halladay. Part of the reason, last year he led the league in run support with over 7 runs a start. Ainsworth looks okay through the first, getting Ortiz and Manny batting cleanup again. In the second, he has runners on first and second with 2 out when Pokey hits a hopper to the hole. Tejada nabs it cleanly. He's moving toward third and looks to Mora for the force, but Mora, not having the instincts of a third baseman, is lagging behind the runner, and Tejada has to plant and throw across his body to first. After hesitating, there's no way he's getting Pokey, so now the bases are loaded. Johnny D slaps a single to left. Swain, bizarrely, sends Bellhorn. The throw beats him by 20 feet but comes in on a short hop, and Javi Lopez can't get a handle on it. 2-0, second and third. Bill Miller hits a single to center. This time the trailing runner is Johnny, and he scores easily. Ainsworth's upset and can't find the plate now, walking Ortiz. He goes 3-1 on Manny before Manny flies to center. It's well hit, but should be caught. Ainsworth takes a few steps toward the dugout, watching Matos, who holds up both arms as if beseeching the sky. He's lost it in the twilight. It hits the track by the base of the wall and bounces high, giving Ortiz more than enough time to chug around. 6-0. Millar rips a single to center. Matos has a shot at Manny, but his throw is offline. And that's it. That's more than enough. Johnny goes 5-for-5 and makes a spectacular grab, going over the fence in front of the O's bullpen to take a 3-run homer away from David Seguí. David Ortiz cranks a 3-run shot down the line in right. Lowe throws well, and Pokey and Bellhorn do a nice job behind him. Even Mendoza gets some work in. But really, it's a one-inning game. It's the kind of win that makes you complacent, that makes you see the O's as a bad club. It's not true. Like the opener, it's just one game. We still have to beat them tomorrow with Wake to take the series.
April 8th. I email Stuart. How about Damon's catch last night? I saw it on tape. That was my game to miss, except for the 8th and 9th. Dinner with friends. Isn't it annoying the way life keeps intruding on baseball?
Besides Johnny having a big night, you didn't miss much. I think Baltimore needs to rethink trying to change Melvin Mora into a third baseman. He's just lost out there, like Todd Walker, no instincts. Then after Lee Mazzilli and the media ream him out, he gets to go home to his wife and their 2-year-old Quince. No wonder he looks like he's going to break into tears any second. You want to hear life intruding on baseball? I've been planning for months to take T to Chicago for our 20th anniversary. Got the plane tickets, hotel reservations, everything. Our first day there is the first game of the World Series. I say, hey, maybe we'll be playing the Cubs. She says, we're not going there for the World Series. I'm not playing second fiddle to the Red Sox.
Oh, God. Does that ever sound familiar? They're playing our song.
There's an official tally of the opening day payrolls. Once again, the Yankees top the majors at $183 million. The Sox are second at $125. The Angels third at $101. By 3, I'm getting antsy and call Naomi. I call 5 times before I get her machine and leave a message. Before I pack the family in the car and drive 100 miles, I want to know the tickets are going to be there. At 4:45, Naomi calls. She's still not sure of the exact location, and the seats may be piggybacked, two in front, two behind, but they'll be there. Thank you, Naomi. You came through like Tommy Brady. I'm sorry I ever doubted you. It's sprinkling at Camden Yards, and the stands are half empty. Wake's going against a young lefty named Matt Riley, who's coming off Tommy John surgery. Ortiz sits, Millar plays right, Burks DHs, and McCarty gets a start at first. Mirabelli, who usually handles Wake, is behind the plate. Along with Bellhorn and Pokey, it's not the most power-packed lineup, so I'm hoping Riley doesn't have much. He doesn't need much. Through 8, our 5 through 9 guys are 0 for 10. The starters leave with the score tied 2-2, and then it's the game that won't end. By the 12th, only Dauber and Mendoza haven't seen action. They show Dauber in the dugout in a Sox watch cap, bent over, his chin propped on the knob of his bat like the one kid who wasn't picked. It's been 4 hours now. Everyone else has long since turned off ER and gone to bed. And with the Sox not scoring in the top of the innings, the bottoms are like a death watch, just waiting for the bad thing to happen. The 25th man, Bobby Jones, is on for us, and gives up a leadoff single to Bigby. Mazzilli chooses to play by the book and has Roberts bunt him over. With two outs and Jones behind 2-0 on Tejada, we walk him intentionally, and then get Palmeiro to ground out on a nice charging play by Bellhorn that Todd Walker wouldn't have made. We do nothing in the 13th. It's raining again, and it's past 11:30. Jones, who's been going deep in the count to every batter, walks Lopez to start the inning. Batista tries to bunt him across only once, then strikes out. The ump's noticeably squeezing the zone on Jones on righties, where in the 10th, he called two pitches well up and in strikes to lefties Tech and Bill Miller. On 3-1, Segui swings but steals a walk by running down to first. On 3-2, Mattis takes an agonizingly close pitch. The ump gives him the home call, and with one out, the bases are loaded. Bigby's up. Jones has him struck out on a 1-2 pitch. Down the pipe, not a nibble job. But again, the ump doesn't call it. Part of it's the lateness of the hour, part of it's the weather, and part has to be just a lack of respect. Jones dips his head and walks in a circle behind the mound. Ortiz visits from first to calm him down. A borderline pitch, and it's 3-2. And then the payoff pitch is up and out, and the game's over. The camera follows Jones off, expecting he'll say something in the direction of the ump. To his credit, he doesn't. I only watch extra innings for a minute, just long enough to hear X say, "Not pretty." As I get ready for bed, I keep replaying the game in my mind, running over the what-ifs, worrying that we'll need this game somewhere down the road. And it was winnable. There was no good reason we lost it, just a terrible ump. I make a note to find his name in the paper tomorrow. April 9th. His name is Alfonso Marquez. It's said an umpire's done a good job when no one notices him or her. Hey, Marquez, I got my eye on you. The paper says Nomar, though he's still on the DL, will be in uniform for the opener today, as if that will placate the crowd. We get going a half hour late, but still arrive a good hour before game time. Parking is horrific. The main lot by the hospital is full, and we cruise Beacon Street down to Coolidge Corner, then try the side streets. We find a spot in a quiet neighborhood about a half a mile away and hump it in. Anyone selling? The scalpers call, but no one is. The will call windows are mobbed and incredibly slow. I wait in line for half an hour and fear we're going to miss the first pitch. As we cut in to get to our section, I realize we're right at Canvas Alley, where the grounds crew hangs out. Up the stairs, and there's the green of the field and the monster and the jammed bleachers with the scoreboard on top. Our seats are right on the alley, about 10 rows back. We've missed the first pitch from Arroyo, but he's still working on the first batter. The milk bottle's gone, Trudy says. And I look up to the roof in right field. The light stanchion there is bare, looming above three tiers of the new table squeezed in beneath a long Budweiser sign. The Hood milk bottle used to flash whenever a Sox pitcher struck someone out, and Hood would donate money in the pitcher's name to the Jimmy Fund. I guess milk and beer don't mix. Also new are Toronto's black road uniforms, which I don't like, They look exactly like the D-rays. Arroyo gets through the first, but makes his own trouble in the second by walking two. The bases are loaded when Reed Johnson doubles off the monster. 2-0 Jays. Behind us are four guys in the brew pub business. One of them is constantly on the phone, trying to cut a deal, hollering as if he doesn't believe the signal will reach. "We can bring 100,000 to start," he says. "I want to say we can go 110, 120 if we have to." He has this conversation with a dozen people as if he's clearing the deal with his partners. "Buddy, it's opening day. Turn off your cell phone." In the third, Bellhorn's on second with two down when Johnny comes up. "Save us, Jeebus," a girl beside us yells, a nifty Simpsons reference. Johnny fouls one off his knee that puts him on the ground. He can't be hurt. We can't afford it. And everyone cheers when he stands in again and bloops one down toward us that drops, making it 2-1. The next batter, Bill Miller, hits another bloop toward us, spinning foul. Delgado's got no shot at it, but Orlando Hudson sprints all the way from second to the line and dives. I see the ball land in his glove just as he disappears, thumping into the padded wall. I have to check the first base ump shadowing the play. He clenches his fist in the outside. Hudson's still not up. We can't see him at all. And then Delgado pulls him to his feet. His whole left side, including his hat, is covered with dirt. And we give him a standing O. That is some Major League Baseball. I hope I catch the replay on ESPN to see how he did it. By now, the crowd's settled, and Trudy and Steph make a run to the concession stand. There's a new 3D cup this year with the four starters on it, along with Fenway, a flag, and an eagle left over from the 2002 model. The company hasn't proofread the thing. Schilling is spelled S-H-I-L-L-I-N-G, and will be all season long. In the fourth, Arroyo lets in two more. He's just not sharp. But in the bottom of the inning, Manny turns on an inside pitch and rips one off of Hinsky at third, the ball rolling into the dugout, giving him second. It's not an error for Hinsky, just a hard chance and a bruise. Ortiz doubles to knock him in, and with two gone, we load the bases for Pokey. He hits a floating liner to left. It looks like it should be caught, but it sails over Frank Catalanato's head to the base of the wall, and the game's tied at four. When the inning ends, I head for the restroom and the concession stand. Everyone else has the same idea, and after I've tracked down some commemorative opening day balls, a Cuban sandwich for Trudy, and a bag of Swedish fish for Caitlin, I'm walking across the big concourse behind right field when a roar goes up from the crowd, and then a roar on top of that that makes everyone turn. I hustle with my arms full to a TV monitor in time to see Tech jog across the plate. He's homered to put us on top 5-4. To preserve the lead in the seventh, Francona brings in lefty Mark Malaska, who didn't even make the club, but who we've brought up from Pawtucket because we went through the entire pen last night. Malaska is asked to get the good-hitting Catalanato, and then last year's number two and number one RBI guys, Vernon Wells and Carlos Delgado. And he does. 1-2-3. Mystery Malaska. In the Toronto eighth, righty Josh Phelps leads off, so Francona opts to go with Mike Timlin, who only threw 2/3 of an inning last night. Timlin K's Phelps, but then has to face lefty Eric Hinsky, who singles, and the switch-hitting Hudson, who doubles to the left-center gap, tying the game. Timlin gets pinch-hitter Simon Bond, but number 9 hitter Kevin Cash doubles to the exact same spot, and the crowd boos. There's nobody warming. Again, the effect of last night. Timlin hits Johnson with a pitch, and people are screaming. Catalanato lines one over Millar's head. Millar turns and does his impression of running, giving a blind wave of his glove. We're lucky. The ball hops into the stands for a ground rule double, and Johnson has to go back to third. When Timlin finally gets Wells to pop up for the third out, it's 7-5 Toronto. We do nothing with our half of the eighth. Embry comes on in the ninth and gives up a rocket of a homer to Delgado. Phelps flies deep to right, and then Embry walks Hinsky. Francona, I suppose to prove he has a sense of humor and to test ours, brings in McCarty. "You should have brought him in for Timlin," someone yells. McCarty actually doesn't look bad, throwing in the mid to high 80s and going to his curve. He gets Hudson to ground one to him, moving Hinsky over. Two down. When he goes to a full count on Chris Gomez, The crowd rises, cheering the absurdity of it. McCarty reaches back and throws one by Varitek all the way to the backstop, walking Gomez and giving Hinsky third. The crowd subsides and then groans when Cash blasts a double to the triangle in center, scoring both runners. It's 10-5, and the casual fans head for the exits, while the diehards sneak down to steal their seats. The good news is that they've changed the numbers on the scoreboard for the Yankees-White Sox game. Chicago's up 5-1 in the fifth. In the bottom of the ninth, with one down and Bellhorn up, Brian Daubak comes out and walks over to the on-deck circle. Bellhorn flies out, and the crowd rises for Dauber. M&M's on the PA. Guess who's back again, hoping he'll give us something to cheer about. He grounds weakly to second, and we've lost the home opener. The walk to the car seems long. At least it's nice out. We mutter about Timlin and laugh at how I missed the one great moment of the game. It's still a good day. On the Mass Pike, we pass a car with a bumper sticker that says, "Job was the first Red Sox fan," and it's early enough in the year that it's still funny. We tune into the Paw Sox playing Buffalo and catch the final of the Yankee game. White Sox 9, Yankees 3. It's the Buffalo station we're pulling in, and as we head west into the night and traffic thins, the signal grows stronger. The Paw Sox are leading 5-4, and mile after mile, we get to catch up with Kevin Euclid.
Today was the first game I missed from beginning to end. I even dipped into last night's late show, catching the 10th and 11th of the game versus Baltimore the Sox ended up dropping in 13. My younger son Owen called me with an update on this one in the fourth, with the Sox down 4-1. "Whoa, make that 4-2, he said in the middle of the call, adding that Manny had hit the hardest line shot he, Owen, had ever seen. Claimed it even looked like a bullet in slow-mo. Red Sox ended up losing 10-5, according to the Fox New England Sports Network ticker, which I, for some reason, get down here in Florida. Ubiquitous Fox. Man, Stuart. I'll wait for the highlights. Lowlights, deadlights. But that doesn't sound like Moneyball, that sounds like Ugly Ball. I'll bet you anything that What's-His-Face, the converted fielder, pitched at least two innings. And the Yankees lost again. The AL East is looking mighty softy, at least in the early going. If I can get the game tomorrow, I intend to be there for the whole deal. It's pretty important, I think, that Pedro be able to play the stopper and get us back to 500 early. Can't wait for the standings tomorrow. 500 should be good enough to lead this fool's parade.
April 10th. While we were waiting in the will call line, we miss Nomar and Yaz and Dewey and Tommy Brady. Damn you, unwieldy ticketing process. The paper says that Mendoza was moved to the DL and that Johnny will be out for a few days with a golf ball-sized lump on his knee. Yesterday, before his first at-bat, they played Iron Man for him, and here a foul ball takes him out. It also says the plane the Sox were supposed to take from Baltimore after the 13-inning game had mechanical problems. And with the delays, the team bus didn't get to Fenway until 7:30 yesterday morning, which might account for their sleepwalking performance. Because we spent all day at the park yesterday, I can't persuade anyone to go to tonight's game, even with the Pedro-Roy Halladay matchup. It frees me to leave early. I rocket across the Mass Pike and get there a full 2.5 hours before game time. I'm the first one in the lot, now $25, though the attendant assures me they raised the price last August. I score my will-call tickets and head for Lansdowne, thinking I might shag some home runs. Like a little kid, I'm lugging my glove. On Brookline Ave, a billboard with a big picture of Nomar asks us to keep the faith. Before I turn the corner, I find a scalper leaning against a wall, muttering, "Anyone buying? Anyone selling?" I tell him I have one, and we haggle. Even though it's hours before game time, it's Pedro Halladay, and I want at least face value. He lowballs, so I walk. But there's a young Korean tourist lurking behind him who steps forward and offers to trade me a Yankee ticket for it. The Patriots Day game, which starts at 11 a.m., way too early for us to get here. I jump on the trade, then turn and sell the $20 bleacher seat to the scalper for well more than the face value of today's ticket, and walk away grinning. It's rare that you scalp a scalper. On Lansdowne, the Sausage King and the Souvenir Guys by Gate E are setting up. A band of college kids wearing long dark wigs and beards walks by. Their shirts say, Damon's Disciples. I stake my claim to a pillar by the entrance to the elevated parking lot, leaning against it to hide my glove behind my back, and watch the monster. I'm almost under the Coke bottles, between them and Fisk's foul pole, the perfect spot for dead pole hitters. But nothing's coming over. It's too early, they're still running the tour groups through. A father and son join me. They've got standing rooms on the monster and they're hoping to catch a ball. I wish them luck and post up by gate E, hoping to be the first one in so I can grab my favorite corner spot down the left field line. After a nervous 5 minutes waiting for them to roll open the corrugated steel doors, I'm the second one through the turnstiles and the first into the grandstand. The Sox are already batting. As I make my way down to the empty corner, I see Johnny Pesky walking out toward left field with a fungo bat and hail him. Johnny joined the club as a shortstop in 1942. He's 85 and still putting on the uniform. He waves back, a Fenway benediction. Bending over the low wall and reaching with my glove, I can just touch the plastic left field foul line. Yeah, weird, not chalk, but a permanent strip of plastic. I wait for a hot grounder into the corner, pounding my glove. Nothing comes. The Sox finish and the Jays take the field. A liner hooks over us for section 33, heads up and bangs into the seats. A few balls off the wall end up in the corner, but these the outfielders toss up or hand to little kids. Out in left, number 27 for the Jays has been shagging flies. As he comes in for his turn in the cage, I see he has a ball in his mitt. Hey, 2-7, I holler, and he looks around and tosses it to me. It's Frank Catalanato, their left fielder and number 2 hitter, whose triple started them off yesterday. Still, nothing down the line. A lot of balls are banging off the monster or reaching the seats. One arcs down into the front row, where a big guy in a windbreaker catches it barehanded against his chest and gets a hand. It's the dad from Lansdowne. The kid's all excited. Later, on his way back out to left, Catalanato picks up a ball from the grass behind third and, amazingly, tosses it to me. When he comes off, I ask if he'll sign one, and he does. It's the only autograph he gives, and while he's not a star, I feel lucky, singled out. BP's finished, and I wander over to Steve's seats behind the Sox on-deck circle. They're dream seats. So close that, say, Manny swinging his taped-up piece of rebar intrudes on your view of Ortiz at the plate. Julie, the assistant who's babysitting Steve's tickets, might be there, and I need to talk to her. I plant myself in his seat and admire the balls and Catalanato's illegible signature. As game time nears, I wonder if Julie's coming. If not, fine, I'll just sit here. Before the game starts, there's already good news on the scoreboard. White Sox 7, Yankees 3. Pedro comes out throwing 89-90. Catalanato singles sharply to center, but that's it in the first. Halliday's up at 93-95. He's 6'4 with a patchy beard, and on the mound he looks Randy Johnson tall. Crespo leads off, and Halliday blows two by him, then freezes him with a backdoor curve. Bill Miller and Ortiz barely get wood on the ball. Looks like it's going to be a quick game. Josh Phelps leads off the top of the second with a drive down the right field line. It looks like it's going to drop, but Kapler digs hard and dives, tumbles in the dust, and comes up with it. It's even bigger when the next batter, Hinsky, rips a single. There's some muttering in the seats, but Pedro bears down and gets Hudson, then gets a borderline call on Woodward, and the faithful stand and cheer him off. When Kapler stands on deck that inning, I call, "Great catch, Gabe," and he turns in profile and nods. I'm so close I can read the writing on his T-shirt under his white home jersey. It's a new tradition with the club. Last year with Grady, the players wore all kinds of inside motivational slogans. "Real niggas" is spelled backwards across Gabe's shoulders. When he pops to third to end the inning, the ump inspects the scuffed ball and gives it to the Sox bat boy, Batman really because he's a pro, Andrew. As Andrew's coming back toward the circle, I call his name and hold up my glove, and he hits me. "Thanks, Andrew." Ortiz is wearing a slogan too. "Are you gonna?" That's all I can get. Both pitchers settle in. There are no rallies, no tight spots, just solo base runners stranded at first, and lots of strikeouts. In the bottom of the sixth, Crespo leads off with a slow roller to short. He busts it down the line and dives headfirst for the bag, safe. It's a spark. Bill Miller rolls one to Delgado, who makes the right decision and goes to second to get Crespo. David Ortiz comes up, El Jefe, and after seeing a few pitches, blasts one deep to right that makes us all rise. It carries the wall and caroms off the roof of the Sox bullpen. In the stands, we're high-fiving. David touches the plate, lifts his eyes, and points with both hands to God. First pitch, Manny lines one for a single. Maybe Halliday's tired. He's thrown 80 pitches, 120 Canadian. He blows away Kapler to end the inning. Pedro's having a quick top of the seventh when, with two down, he gets behind Hudson, 2-1. Hudson's the number seven hitter, a second baseman, and not a big guy, so Pedro goes after him. He can't get his 90-mile-per-hour fastball past him, and Hudson parks it in the Jays' bullpen. It's only 2-1 for one batter as Bellhorn leads off the bottom with a slicing, pesky pole homer. Pedro K's the first batter at the top of the eighth. It's his last inning, and as he sometimes does, he's going to sign the win by striking out the side. Except after Catalanato takes a backdoor curve for strike three, here comes Francona from the dugout. Pedro looks around, surprised. He glances out to the bullpen where Falk is warming, as if he had no idea. Francona chucks Pedro on the shoulder as if to say good job and takes the ball from him.
Boo!
Pedro high-fives everyone in conference at the mound. Then, as he's walking off, before crossing the first baseline, touches his heart, kisses his pitching hand, and points to God. Huge standing O. At the top of the dugout steps, he stops and points to God again, holding the pose a little too long, but hey, that's Pedro. This is the kind of showboating that gets him booed in other parks, but here, after taking on Halliday, it's okay. Petey's thrown 106 pitches, but I wonder if it's more of a power move on Francona's part, taking an early opportunity to show the media and the talk radio fans that this is his club, and he can make Pedro do something he doesn't want to do, as opposed to Grady, who couldn't take the ball from him when it was clear he needed to come out. Falk gets Vernon Wells on a roller, so it's a good move, or at least not a bad one. Manager Carlos Tosca decides to close the Mike Socha way, bringing in a lefty to get Ortiz, then pulling him for a righty to face Manny. Manny, uncharacteristically, swings at the first pitch and greets Aquilino Lopez with a bomb to center that just keeps going. It's hit into the wind, but ends up a few rows deep in section 36, somewhere around 450 feet. 4-1 Sox. After that, Tosca says the hell with it and leaves Lopez in to finish. As we start the ninth, the crowd singing Sweet Caroline a cappella long after Neil Diamond's finished. It's a party. And when the folks in the front row take off to beat the traffic, I move up and stand at the wall with my hands on the bunting. Real cloth, not plastic, as you might expect, as Falk closes. It's only 9:30. It's been the fast, clean game you'd expect from two Cy Youngs, all the scoring on long balls. The high floats me home. Traffic's light, and I'm entirely satisfied. There's nothing to nitpick or second guess, no needling what-ifs. Pedro wasn't dominant, but he was very, very good. Ortiz delivered the big blow. Manny was 3-for-4. Kapler made that great diving catch. And this is silly since it's not even Easter yet. With Baltimore whipping up on Tampa Bay, I do believe we own a share of first place. I get an email from Steve.
Well, well, good game. Petey looked like Petey. And Roy Halliday surely looked like he was saying, fuck, shit. After the Ortiz home run in the sixth. On the replay, too. So the Red Sox climbed to 500 for the third time in the young season. Now for the really interesting question. Since most of us watch these things on TV, hell, I'm 1,000 miles from Fenway, give or take a few, who pays the freight? Mostly dad-oriented companies, as you might guess. But one of the heavy rotation sponsors, McDonald's, features hungry ladies leaving a baby shower and booking straight for Mickey D's, where they gobble turkey clubs on pita bread. And maybe that's not so strange. I watched tonight with my 80-year-old mother-in-law, who went directly from the Bo Sox game upstairs to Maine Denver Frozen Four hockey downstairs. Also, for your consideration, the following big league sponsors: Tweeter, just sit back and enjoy; Dunkin' Donuts; Kurt Schilling with a Walkman, learning to speak New England; Foxwoods Casino, the wonder of it all; Geico Insurance, good news, your rap sucks, but I saved a bundle; Extra Mart, fuel up on Brew Boy Coffee; SBC Phone Service, old farts, please phone home; Friendly's Restaurants, sorry, Dad, no sports car for you; TD Waterhouse, know your investment risk; Cool TV, i.e., watch more Boston Bruins hockey; Funny Bears Drink Pepsi Cola; Volvo, official car of the Boston Red Sox; Camry, the car of caring dads; Rico Color Printers, because, face it, black and white sucks; Dunkin' Donuts again, Kurt again, wicked hard; Albert Pujols for DirecTV, my bat is always talking to me; seek help, Albert, seek help; Aflac, the anthrax duck. Interestingly enough, no beer ads until after 9, when they come in a suds, flood. And goodness, are they ever suggesting young men should drink a lot, especially the Coors Light ads. Also, Foxwoods advertises a lot, the strong suggestion of the ads being that the wonder of it all involves pulling a great many chrome-plated handles a great many times. I thought you, and possibly TV-watching fans everywhere, should know these things. Now, all together, Aflac. P.S. Did you see Johnny's Cavemen? Are they the perfect bleacher creatures or what?
Speaking of advertising, for the first time the dugouts are plastered with Ford ovals, like the Jays wallpapered with Canadian Tire ads. I saw Damon's disciples before, during, and after the game. A shame Johnny didn't play. Crespo hustled, 2 infield hits, and played center passably. Let's hope Millar's days roaming Trot's yard are over. April 11th. Poor old Dauber. Because we've been eating up the pen, we need fresh arms, and ship him to Pawtucket to bring up a ghost, Frank Castillo, who we dumped last year and then re-signed this February. Dauber will have to clear waivers before reporting. The odds are slim that anyone will claim him, but why take the chance if he's really part of the team? Johnny says he saw his disciples as he was coming out of the players' lot. They have shirts that said, "We have Jesus on our side." It's Schilling's Fenway debut, and I'm not going. For the first time in my life, I'm going to be a no-show, eating a pair of grandstands along with Easter dinner. I tell Steph that Schilling better not throw a no-hitter. A perfect game, he says. Instead, it's an extra-inning nail-biter that takes all day. Mystery Malaska battles again, taking us into the 13th. So who do we bring in next, Steph asks. Williamson? We won't have to, I say. We're doing it here. To seal the oath, we high-five around the room. It's Aquilino Lopez's game. He walks Bill Miller, bringing up David Ortiz. With Manny next, Lopez has to throw to him. He tries to nibble, then gives in and puts one over the plate. Ortiz hits a rainbow that brings us to our feet. Get out! It's headed for deep left center. It's going to make the wall, and now it's clear it's going to carry it. The ball lands in the second row of the monster seats, in the aisle between M7 and M8, ricocheting off a fan who scrambles after the magical souvenir. The Sox win 6-4, and the whole club gathers at home to pound David on the helmet and bounce up and down as a team. Too bad Dauber missed this one. Now I wish I'd gone. A walk-off job's rare, but we're celebrating here too, hooting and running to the kitchen to mob Trudy as if she hit it. Now it is officially a happy Easter, I say. The temptation is to see this as a defining moment, proof that we're in for a wild year. It's a win, that's all, but a very satisfying one. Though it's only April, with one swing, emotionally, we've made up for blowing both openers. April 12th. In the mail, there's a promotional postcard for Steph, a handsomely designed riff on a fight poster that says, "Showdown in Beantown. touting Friday's Yankee game on Fox, the network's first regular season game in primetime in years. We've got monster seats for Sunday's Yankee game, and I'm hoping to catch 2 field boxes from Steve for Friday's showdown. Francona says he's not going to use the off day to give Pedro an extra day of rest, meaning we'll skip Arroyo, and Petey will go in his normal slot Thursday night against the O's. Maybe a revenge game for him? This way, Schilling stays on track for 35 starts rather than 33, and Pedro sees the Yanks down in the stadium the weekend after next. So Schilling will go this Friday, as he's planned since February. Steph and I figure out we'll see Wake on Sunday, and then on Thursday against Tampa Bay, Wake again. It's a good thing Steph likes Timé. Last year we went through a goofy stretch where he saw 5 straight home starts of his. But that's only if the weather holds. It's spring, Steph reminds me. We're probably going to have some rainouts. April 13th. A dark, cold day. It pours all afternoon, and the Sox cancel tonight's game early. There's no rescheduled date and no rush since Baltimore comes through again in July and September. The rainout itself is depressing, as if a party's been called off, and makes the day that much gloomier. I get an email from Steve.
It was an insult that they shipped Dauber. The injury was that they shipped him for Frank.
Funny how Crespo's turned into our utility everything. Had a big spring beating out Shump and Tony Woe, and now he's playing infield and outfield and getting 4 or 5 at-bats a game while Dauber's rotting in Pawtucket. You can't teach speed. April 14th. My 2004 media guide arrives, with a picture of D'Lo on the cover celebrating the Game 5 win over Oakland. Except the background isn't from that game, but from the wild card clincher at Fenway, with the fans on their feet and the whole bench bolting from the dugout. Matted in below this are press conference shots of Schilling, Francona, and Fulk holding up their new Sox unis, the symbolism unmistakable, as if adding these 3 elements together will produce a championship. Just for fun, the text of the guide is printed in blue and red ink this year. 627 pages of stats and oddball facts like, last year with the White Sox, Dauber stole home. In college, Mark Melaska was a slugging outfielder. Cesar Crespo's brother Felipe played for the Giants and homered twice in the same game in which Cesar hit his first major league homer with the Padres. Among the career highlights and personal trivia, I recognize dozens of lines I've already heard from Don and Jerry. As if 627 pages aren't enough, I hit the local bookstore and pick up Jerry Remy's Watching Baseball just out. As a color analyst, he's usually pretty good with strategy, and I'm always willing to learn. I'm not disappointed. While a lot of it is basic, he also talks a fair amount about setting the defense according to the batter, the count, and the pitch, and how important it is not to give your position away. He also lays out the toughest plays for each position, and the slight advantages base runners can take of pitchers and outfielders. I'm psyched to use some of my new knowledge watching the game, but the website says it's been canceled due to inclement weather and unplayable field conditions. It's a letdown, as if I was supposed to play. After Sunday's walk-off homer, I'm feeling a little withdrawal. April 15th. It's raining when I wake up, but by mid-morning the sun's out, so I think we're okay. Even better, in the mail are Steve's dream seats for tomorrow night's game, along with a parking pass. Look for me on Fox. Last year, for one nationally televised game, we noticed that Todd Walker was mic'd, a transmitter tucked in his back pocket. Every time he was on deck, we yelled, "Rupert Murdoch sucks!" Sunday's game is on-field photo day. I call up Sox customer service to find out more, but the woman there doesn't know when it starts or what gate you need to go in or where the line will form. In the paper, the Yanks asked UConn men's hoops coach Jim Calhoun if he'd throw out the first ball at one of their games. Coach Calhoun's a serious Sox fan. After his squad won it all in 99, beating a Yankee-like Duke team, he threw out the first pitch up at Fenway. No chance, he tells the Yanks. 60 years of torment is enough. The confusion the Yanks had is natural. The moneyed southwestern corner of Connecticut drains toward New York and historically supports the more established Gotham teams. For a couple years before moving to Jersey, the football Giants played in the Yale Bowl. The northern and eastern edges of the state, butted up against Massachusetts and Rhode Island, are country, decidedly New England. The suburban middle where I live is disputed territory. On the Sox website, there's a petition for Connecticut residents to sign, pledging their loyalty based on traditional New England values of hard work and fair play, and denouncing the encroachment of, yes, the evil empire. I've signed, though what good it does against Georgia's bounty hunters and clone army, I have no idea. The game goes on as scheduled. Ben Affleck's in the front row beside the Sox dugout. He emceed the Sox welcome back luncheon the other day, and I expect he'll be there tomorrow against the Yanks. With the rainouts, neither pitcher's seen action for a while. Pedro gives up a leadoff home run to Roberts. He's missing spots, walking people, giving up another run in the second. But Ponson loads the bases, and Johnny singles to right. And then Bill Miller breaks an 0-for-20 drought with a pesky pole wraparound, and we're up 5-2. It's early, but the game seems in hand, and the home folks have shows they want to watch. So we switch over to Survivor, and then The Apprentice. Don't worry, Steve, we're taping Kingdom Hospital. Clicking back to Nesson every so often. It's 5-4 Sox in the fourth when we check in. Just in time to see Johnny knock in Bellhorn. Ponson's struggling, and Tejada doesn't help him by dropping the transfer on a sure double play. Ortiz grounds to the right side and Pokey scores, 7-4. When we check in again, it's 7-7 in the top of the fifth, and Pedro's still in there. What the hell? Palmeiro hit a 3-run shot into the Sox bullpen. He's given up 8 hits and 4 walks. Yank him already. Ponson's gone after 4, and Malaska comes on for us in the top of the 6th. It's the big finale of The Apprentice, and for 2 hours we play peekaboo with the relievers. Lopez, Williamson, Timlin, Ryan, Falk, Embry. The Apprentice ends just in time for us to catch the biggest play of the game. It's the bottom of the 10th, bases loaded, and 2 out for Bill Miller. He lifts one high and deep to left center that looks like it'll scrape the monster. I'm up, cheering, thinking this is the game, that we'll have a little cushion going into the Yankee series. But the wind knocks the ball down. Bigby is coming over from left, and Mattos from center on a collision course. Bigby cuts in front, Mattos behind, making the grab on the track in front of the scoreboard, and that's the inning. Arroyo starts the top of the 11th against Tejada. He hangs a curve, and Tejada hits it off the foot of the light tower on the monster for his first homer of the year. 8-7 O's. In a long and ugly sequence, they pile on 4 more. We go 1-2-3, and that's the game. A painful bullpen-clearing, 4.5-hour extra-inning loss, very much like last week's in Baltimore. Not the way we wanted to go into tomorrow's opener against the Yanks. And not how I wanted to go to bed. Late and pissed off. April 16th. The Sox are unveiling a statue of Ted Williams today outside Gate B, the gate no one uses, way back on Van Ness Street, behind the right field concourse. The statue is part of an ongoing beautification effort. We've already widened the sidewalks and planted trees to try to disguise the fact that Van Ness is essentially a gritty little back street with more than its share of broken glass. I'm surprised there's not a statue of Williams already, the way the faithful venerate him. During the Pedro Halliday game, I chanced across a rolling wooden podium with a bronze plaque inlaid on top honoring Ted. It looked like something from the 60s, coated with antique green milk paint. It was pushed against a wall in the hallway inside Gate A, next to the old electric organ no one ever plays. I'd never seen it before, and wondered why it was shoved to the side. In Pittsburgh, there was a statue of Honus Wagner by the entrance of Forbes Field. And when the Bucks moved to Three Rivers, it moved with them, to be joined by a statue of Clemente. And now at PNC Park, one of Willie Stargell. I wonder how long it will take the Sox to commission one of Yaz. Because the game's on Fox, the start time's been pushed back to 8:05, giving me some extra time to deal with Friday rush hour. All the way up 84 and across the Mass Pike, I see a lot of New York and New Jersey plates. When I pull into the lot behind Harvard Med Center a good hour before the gates open, it's already half filled. I head for Lansdowne, but BP hasn't started yet. There are some Yankee fans outside the Cask and Flagon having their pictures taken. Skinny college girls in pink Yankee t-shirts and hats, with a hefty dude in an A-Rod jersey. I pass a woman wearing a t-shirt that says, This is your brain above a Red Sox logo. This is your brain on drugs and a Yankees logo. TV crews are wandering around doing stand-ups, shooting B-roll of people eating by the sausage guy. Above, banner planes and helicopters crisscross. I walk down Lansdowne past the nightclubs, figuring I'll go around the long way and check out the statue. Fuel is playing the Avalon Ballroom. Their fans are sitting against the wall to be the first in, and seem disgusted that their good time has been hijacked by a bunch of dumb jocks. When I turn the corner onto Ipswich, I find another line of young people waiting at the entrance of a parking lot. Everyone has an ID on a necklace, as if they're all part of a tour group. Then I notice the yellow Aramark shirts hidden under their jackets. It's the vendors queuing up so they can get ready for a big night. It's already cold in the shadows, and I pity the guys trying to move ice cream. I expect the Williams statue to be ringed by fans taking pictures or touching it for luck, the way they do in Pittsburgh with Clemente and Stargell. If you reach up, you can balance a lucky penny on Willie's elbow. But it's just standing there alone while a line waits about 30 feet away for day-of-game tickets. It's uninspired and uninspiring. A tall man stooping to set his oversized cap on a little bronze kid's head. It's not that Ted didn't love kids. His work with the Jimmy Fund is a great legacy. It's just that I expected something more dynamic for the greatest hitter that ever lived. In Pittsburgh, Clemente's just finished his swing and is about to toss the bat away and dig for first. He's on his toes, caught in motion. And there's a paradoxical lightness to the giant structure that conveys Clemente's speed and grace. Stargell's cocked and waiting for his pitch, his bat held high. You can almost see him waggling the barrel back and forth behind his head. This Williams is static and dull and carries none of the kid's personality. He could be any Norman Rockwell schmoo making nice with the little tyke. I take a couple of pictures anyway, then head back to Gate E to wait for my friend Lowry. Before a big game like this, people are handing out all sorts of crummy free stuff, and I accept a globe just to have something to read. Okay, and for the poster of Nomar. I buy a bag of peanuts and lurk at the corrugated door, and when Lowry comes, we're first in line, and then the first in and the first to get a ball, tossed to me by David McCarty in left. I snag a grounder by Kapler, and later an errant warm-up throw by Yanks coach and former Pirate prospect Willie Randolph, picking the neat short hop out of sheer reflex. A-Rod comes out to warm, and the fans boo. Some migrate over from other sections just to holler at him while he plays long toss, chucking the ball from the third base line out to deep right center. Hey, lend me $100, huh? How you liking third? Hey, A-Rod, break a leg, and I mean that. We boo Jeter when he steps in to hit. And Giambi. Balco! And Sheffield. Balco! The rest of the Yanks are friendly enough. Jose Contreras and Kevin Brown banter with the fans. Even hothead Jorge Posada jokes with us. When Messina comes by and chats and smiles, someone calls, "You're the good Yankee, Mike." Miguel Cairo, one of the last Yankees to bat, smokes a grounder down the line. It's mine. I catch it off center and it bends the fingers of my mitt back. The ball knocks off the wall and rolls away, out of reach, gone forever. It's a play I'll make 99 times out of 100, even if it was hit hard. Hey, Lowry says, you've got three. Yeah, I say, I know, but it's always the one that gets away that you remember. We stop by El Teante's for an autographed picture, saying hey to Louie, and picking up some Cuban sandwiches, then fight the crowd to reach our seats. The choke point's right behind home, where the concourse narrows to feed the first ramp to the stands. The crush is worse than opening day, and I think they've got to fix it somehow before something very bad happens. The tide of people separates us. I find Lowry at our seats just as the anthem begins. As always, I'm overwhelmed by how good these seats are. One section over, one row in front of us, is the governor of Massachusetts, Mitt Romney. The Yanks send Kenny Lofton, Jeter, and A-Rod to face Wake in the first. The boos grow louder with each at-bat, peaking with A-Rod, who gets a standing excoriation, something only Clemens has managed over the years. "Gay Rod," some wags are chanting. When Tim's first pitch is a strike, the crowd explodes, as if we've won. Johnny opens with a hopper to first that hits Giambi in the middle and gets through him for an E. Balco! Vasquez has Bill Miller 0-2, but gets impatient, aiming a fastball that Billy cranks into the Sox bullpen, and we're up 2-0. Manny hits a slicing liner down the right field line that disappears from view. The ump signals fair, then twirls one finger in the air for a homer. Somehow the Yanks are able to relay the ball in. They're arguing that it never went out. We don't get a replay. Later, I hear that the ball hit the top of the wall and caromed back in off Sheffield, so it wasn't a homer. With two down and Ellis Burks on second, Doug Mirabelli grounds one to Jeter. It's an easy play, but Jeter comes up and lets it through the five hole and into left. And with two outs, Burks scores easily. Posada gets one back with a solo homer in the second. In the fourth, Mirabelli, who, like Wake, is only making his second start, takes Vasquez deep on the first pitch. 5-1. A great moment in the sixth when the Yanks try a double steal. Or is it a blown hit and run? Sheffield doesn't make contact, and A-Rod's meet at third. The crowd taunts him into the dugout. It's 6-2 with two out in the eighth when Giambi lofts a fly to Manny and left. "Good inning," I holler to Doug Mirabelli heading off. And then I see the ball glance off Manny's glove and bounce in the grass. He Charlie Browned it. I look around to verify that this has actually happened. No one else can believe it either. Things get a little shaky when Sheffield and Posada both work walks to load the bases. "A home run here and the game's tied," a neighbor says. I know where this is coming from, but come on, we're up 6-2 with four outs to go. Have some faith. Embry gets Matsui and the Yanks never threaten again. And when Jeter makes the last out and the PA plays Dirty Water, all the different TV crews hustle to set up their tall director's chairs for the post-game shows. April 17th. Steve and I have been going back and forth about the Yankees' place in our cosmos. I've been trying to argue that they've only gotten in our way a few times across our overall history. In the 50s and 60s, besides the impossible dream year, we were so bad that it didn't matter. 78's a fluke, and people forget that after our big fold in August, we came back and won our last eight to gain the tie for the division. The Winfield-Mattingly Yanks never gave us any problems. We're, in fact, massive chokers, consistently finishing second to Toronto, Baltimore, and us. In 86, we stood in our own way, or Calvin Schiraldi did. In 99, we were lucky to get by Cleveland, and last year we pulled a rabbit out of our hat to beat Oakland, and were playing on the road the whole time. Plus, we took enough out of the Yanks that they had nothing left for the Marlins. We were their stumbling block, beating them twice at the stadium, putting their weaknesses on display. All the Marlins had to do was mop them up. I get an email from Steve.
"Your rationalizations can't stand up to the killer graphics Fox put up on the screen last night. I'll get the facts for my little Yankees-Sox piece, and no, it hasn't always been the Yankees, just the Dent home run, the Boston Massacre, and last year. Plus the Boston Yankees' all-time numbers, which are all New York. But while we've been starving, New York has been feasting. How many consecutive years have they gone to the postseason now, 12? Come on, you gotta hate them. Fear them and hate them."
You forget, my roots are in Pittsburgh, and Maz's homer is our Excalibur. We not only slew the beast, we broke their damn hearts, and the Sox can do it too. Shoot, if we really wanted to win one, we could go the 97 Marlins route, or the 2001 D-backs. We're almost there, but not quite. But that's not an honorable way. That's why all the Steinbrenner titles don't count. The last time the Yanks really won anything was 1962.
Maz's homer is our Excalibur. Mine too. I love that series. Remember that Baltimore chop that hit Tony Kubek in the Adam's apple? Of course you do, you devil you.
As Bob Prince used to say, we had him all the way.
The game last night was the perfect antidote. Except for Scott Williamson in the eighth. Pretty scary Halloween Mary. A measure of payback for Tim A. Wakefield after the heartbreaking home run to Aaron Boone. One game down, 18 to go.
One luxury of having two bona fide aces is the constant possibility of a marquee matchup. Last Saturday, it was Pedro Halliday. This Saturday, it's Schilling Messina. With the watering down of pitching talent around the league, these games are rare. And I'd be at Fenway except that I have to tape an interview for Canadian TV. Moose is rocky from the start, and Schilling's solid. Bill Miller goes deep, and Manny. It's 4-1 in the seventh when Schilling's 121st pitch freezes Jeter for the first out. And suddenly, here comes Francona from the dugout. Like Pedro against Toronto, Schilling looks around, surprised someone is warming. He turns his head and swears, but gives up the ball and gets a big hand. A few minutes later, the camera shows him in the dugout going over his charts. Another power move by Francona? Or just notice that he won't be like Grady? I think it's no coincidence that he pulled both aces at home during high-profile wins. Johnny doubles in an insurance run in the eighth, and the Yanks get a cheapie in the ninth, but this one's over. Schilling beats Moose, and we've taken the first two. On extra innings, Tom Caron says, "So the worst we can do is split." Why think of the worst, especially right now? We've got D'Lo going against Contreras tomorrow. It's this kind of fatalism from the Sox's own network that drives me crazy. You never hear this kind of hedging from the Yankees' yes-men,